From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. This weekend, the fourth Rambo film opened, 20 years after the first one.
Who are they to protest me, huh? Who are they? Unless they've been me and been there and know what the hell they're yelling about!
It was a bad time for everyone, Rambo. It's all in the past now.
For you! For me, civilian life is nothing! Back there, I could fly a gunship. I could drive a tank. I was in charge of million-dollar equipment! Back here, I can't even hold the job!
John Rambo, played by Sylvester Stallone, is an American soldier, brave and strong and twisted. He is, of course, a veteran of the Vietnam War. I say of course because there is a persistent and pervasive stereotype of the Vietnam vet, fueled by such films as The Deer Hunter, Coming Home, or Born on the 4th of July, that is not the picture of mental health.
People, gosh, really forget that most people came back from Vietnam and just went back into civilian life.
Jerry Lemke is the author of The Spitting Image, Myth, Memory, and the Legacy of Vietnam.
What people remember is the guy who stands on the street corner with the Vietnam vet will work for food sign, and the people who got into legal problems and claimed Vietnam War experience and PTSD as alibis or defenses for those crimes. And those are the people that Hollywood gives us lots of images of. And yeah, I think that if we're not aware of what happened with the Vietnam veterans, that yeah, this very much could repeat itself in this new era.
So why start our program with Rambo? Because some veterans fear that the Hollywood depiction of the depressed or the deranged vet could reassert itself. It's that fear that may underlie the rage generated in some precincts of the military blogosphere by a piece in the New York Times earlier this month. The paper kicked off a series about veterans with a 6,000-word report presenting the tragic and troubling stories of some of 121 veterans of Iraq and Afghanistan who had killed or been charged with killing after they came home. The Times compiled its list by searching news reports and public records, and with the help of interviews with the soldiers, their families, lawyers, law enforcement, and the military. Lieutenant Colonel and military historian Robert Bateman is among the enraged, and he says he's the one who usually defends the press.
I do. I try and explain to my friends and my peers that journalism is not out to get us. And then in the past couple of weeks, the New York Times just dug a big pit, filled it with slime, and dove in headfirst.
He charges the Times with not contextualizing the number of veteran homicides, 121, which the paper cites as evidence of, quote, a quiet phenomenon tracing a cross-country trail of death and heartbreak.
They never mentioned that there had been at least 700,000 veterans who have come back from Iraq and Afghanistan. They never mentioned that if you compared that, say, as a percentage, you know, how many acts of mayhem per 100,000 returning veterans had occurred. They never noted that it's many times less than what the average civilian rate is. Journalists often complain that they get blamed for broadcasting when there's bad news, when there's a bomb going off in Iraq. And they often say, hey, look, you don't report that the sky is still blue. Well, this story is essentially reporting not only is the sky blue, but it's a bright and sunny day.
The Times researched homicides by veterans for the 6 years preceding the invasion of Afghanistan in 2001 and for the 6 years after. They found an 89% increase from 184 cases of homicide to 349 cases, about three-quarters of which involved Iraq and Afghanistan war veterans. Deborah Sontag co-wrote the article headlined, Across America, Deadly Echoes of Foreign Battles.
We felt that our number was the minimum of cases that were out there that we could find, that there are probably many, many more that we are not finding. And so to come up with some kind of rate of homicide based on a shaky number, a minimum number, would not really serve a purpose. And we did not think it would serve a purpose either to compare what the soldiers were doing with what civilians in the world at large were doing, because this is a distinct universe of individuals who were screened and vetted by the military before joining the service, who do not have a prior criminal record, which the majority of homicide offenders in this country do.
Paul Rykoff is the executive director and founder of the Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America. He says the reaction of veterans to the Times piece was mixed.
I know that some of the military bloggers were really aggressive in pushing back against this piece and felt that it was kind of an overly dramatic piece that didn't provide enough perspective. Other veterans were happy to see that the Times was covering veterans' issues with such a high level of attention.
He says that veterans tend to be hyper-vigilant when it comes to stories about them because they are so often misunderstood.
Less than 0.5% of the American population has served in Iraq and Afghanistan. And if you compare it to World War II, where there was about 12% of the population that had served, there was just a general understanding throughout the population and throughout the media, a more in-depth understanding of what the military was all about, the nuance of the military, and I think the issues associated with combat. The bottom line is that nobody comes home from war unchanged. People don't all come home with amputations. They don't all come home with PTSD, but everyone comes home a little bit different. And I think as a country, if we can better understand that, we'll all be better off.
But the veterans of World War II had it far easier than those from Vietnam, who returned in defeat from a deeply unpopular war for which they were held responsible. Veterans' benefits had shriveled, nor was there ready access to treatment for post-traumatic stress disorder or post-Vietnam syndrome, as it was called. There wasn't much public awareness of the problem when Johnny came marching home. The movies came later. In fact, PTSD wasn't added to the Standard Manual of Psychiatric Disorders until 1980. Washington Post reporter Dana Priest has written extensively about veterans' issues, including breaking the story of scandalous conditions at Walter Reed Army Medical Center. She says the specter of the Vietnam vet still haunts many reporters on the veteran beat.
I think part of that is driven by the understanding that we didn't do right the last time around during a controversial war, and a lot of people suffered because of it who should not have suffered.
After Priest's article about Walter Reed, millions of dollars were devoted to solving that problem, and arguably the media's focus on PTSD has helped to expand resources there as well. But how much coverage is too much? Vietnam historian Jerry Lemke says that trauma already has become a distraction that takes the public's eye off the issue of the war itself.
The press very much made the coming home experiences of Persian Gulf War veterans and now Iraq War veterans a story about war trauma. That's the primary narrative, the primary story that's being told by the press.
The trend has found its way to Hollywood in the film In the Valley of Elah, about a retired MP investigating the death of his soldier son near his base in New Mexico.
Retired cop or just watch a lot of TV?
Military police retired.
Then you should know. Army has jurisdiction over its own personnel. I'm sorry. I hope you find your son.
Hey, I don't know what you think your job is, but if it's anything like mine was, it's to roll up drunks, twiddle your thumbs, not ask too many questions. But my son has spent the last 18 months bringing democracy to a hole and serving his country. He deserves better than this.
It moves the conflict from Iraq to a conflict here.
Jerry Lemke.
In this case, the investigators, the police department, you know, the father trying to find out the truth of what's happened, and then the guys that came back. They're kind of messed up because of the war. It reminded me very much of Vietnam War films, post-Vietnam War films, absolutely.
The Post's Dana Priest sees two narratives emerging of the Iraq and Afghanistan vet. There's the one of the soldier facing the challenge of physical disability, of amputation, say, with great courage and great support from family and community. And then there's the silent sufferer.
One of my favorite things to remind people who want to go visit Walter Reed is that, you know, the president and his envoys who go over there to make people feel better, to buck them up, they never go to the psychiatric ward. They never trot out a soldier with PTSD who has come through it or who has gotten 90% better than when he or she went in the ward to say, look, I survived this and this is how I did it.
I think the narrative of the Iraq War veteran is still a bit murky.
Paul Rykoff of the Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America says it will depend in part on the media.
And at the same time, it's going to depend on how veterans do. Give them 5 or 10 years and let's see how many of them are in Congress and how many of them are in jail, how many of them are continuing to serve in the military and how many are working in the media themselves. Having those folks making up a part, at least a small percentage of the population in the media, is incredibly valuable.
But already, he says, the narrative is much improved. The Iraq vet will never suffer the fate of the veterans of Vietnam.
They were really suffering the full brunt and energy that was associated with the war in a very personal way. And I think, thankfully, people like me who've come home have been treated well, regardless of how people feel about this war. They've honored our service, they've respected our service, and they can separate us from the policy. And I think that's a key development in the American consciousness since Vietnam.
Deborah Sontag of the New York Times says the point of the pieces that have appeared in her paper is to ensure that there are no more silent sufferers.
If you read, really read what we've written, we try and see the crime that has been committed in the context of this individual's service, life, character, and community. The people who commit these homicides on their return are an incredible minority, a teeny-weeny minority. But the individuals who return from Iraq and Afghanistan and become dysfunctional are a larger minority. And if you look at the details of these cases, as some of the vets who have called us have said, they look at these cases and they say, there but for the grace of God go I. And so we don't want to snip off this portion of people and say they are not to be discussed. In some ways, looking at the extreme situations that these guys have gotten themselves into and the horrible damage that they've caused is revealing. That's what we wanted to say.
It's always difficult, she says, to discuss the consequences of a war while it is being waged. But the sooner those stories are told, the sooner attention will be paid. The narrative of the unhinged Vietnam vet was, after all, also the story of an indifferent, ignorant nation. Perhaps that one, too, will be different.
Coming up, President Sarkozy is in love with Carla Bruni.
And with the media. Get a room already. This is On the Media from NPR. This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Actor Heath Ledger died this week at the age of 28. That bare, sad fact would have been challenging enough in the old three network days, but in today's 24-hour, no, make that 1,440-minute news cycle, a vacuum of information simply will not do. It must be filled with factual tidbits, dots to be connected. This is how a rolled-up $20 bill and a few bottles of prescription drugs suddenly translates into a squalid life of drug abuse and despondency. Such is the geometry of modern journalism, where two points miraculously form a three-dimensional object. Of course, news organizations themselves have no wish to be guessing. On the contrary, they like to be prepared. When Irving Berlin and Bob Hope died, the story was uncomplicated and the obituaries long since written. But what about young celebrities? The Associated Press has more than 1,000 of what it calls prepared obits, and not all of them are dedicated to geriatric luminaries. For instance, in the event of Britney Spears' untimely passing, the AP is ready to go. For Heath Ledger, it surely was not. So by what calculus does a news organization nominate 20-somethings for the journalistic equivalent of a death pool? Jesse Washington is entertainment editor of the Associated Press. Jesse, welcome to On the Media.
Thanks for having me.
At what point during the reality show that has become Britney Spears' life did the AP say, okay, there is a chance that this show is going to end sooner rather than later. Let's get something on paper.
It was fairly recently. I can't pinpoint the exact moment. I think that everyone would agree that she's in trouble and does not seem to be improving. So we decided to get ready if the worst-case scenario happened.
At what point did self-destructive behavior by young celebrities get the attention of the people on your obit desk? Is she the first under 30 who has had the dubious distinction of getting a prepared obit?
She is not, but to back up a minute, the obit desk really exists all throughout the whole world at the AP, and every editor such as myself is responsible for being prepared in their area. So we don't have some morbid group of individuals sitting around looking at folks who are ready to keel over. It's more us exercising our news judgment. For me, anyway, it's a pretty simple two factors. How likely is the person to die, and how big a story is it going to be when they do? And the higher up the charts those two things go, the more likely we are to take someone and assign them the obit.
The late part of the 20th century gave us no shortage of celebrities whose self-destructive lifestyles led to their untimely deaths. Jimi Hendrix, Janis Joplin, Kurt Cobain, John Belushi, and so forth. At what point did the AP sort of glom onto this phenomenon and start getting prepared?
Well, I like to think that we would never glom. I like to think in more noble terms than that. However, it's been pretty recently because celebrity news has become so big in the past couple of years. For example, I was at a panel yesterday speaking to some entertainment publicists, and several people there in the course of the discussion said, and when Heath Ledger died, my mom contacted me. 5 years ago, if Heath Ledger died, our mom would probably read about it the next day in the newspaper. Now our moms are reading about it when they log on to check their email. So the world has changed. People's interest in celebrities has changed. The way people consume news has changed. And the way people communicate about it has changed. You have to be more prepared. If we wait an hour to have a really good obituary for someone like Heath Ledger, we're totally out of the game. And that's not a place that I ever want to be.
A few minutes ago, I saw a video of the British singer Amy Winehouse allegedly, apparently, smoking crack and otherwise under the influence of drugs and so forth. A video that is all over the internet. It was broken by The Sun, a British tabloid. Has that incident put her on the AP's watch list?
Amy Winehouse has been on our radar for some time now, as far as obits go. So it didn't take that video for us to have that thought.
Of course, the question I want to ask you, and you certainly won't answer, is who else is on the list? Do you have internal discussions of whether someone, you know, sort of rates the premature death prepared obit list?
The only discussion is usually from the reporter trying to get out of writing it.
Jesse, it's been a pleasure talking to you. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Jesse Washington is the entertainment editor for the Associated Press.
A recent Reuters article, Dateline Paris, began with the following sentence, quote, "Sex, diamonds, and rivalries swirl in the latest chapter of the soap opera gripping France, the story of President Nicolas Sarkozy's love life." In the current issue of The New Yorker, Adam Gopnik observes that the French publications have dubbed Sarkozy the bling-bling president, a reference to his taste for luxury goods, and that many newspapers have deemed the whole affair to be rather vulgar and therefore rather American. By all evidence, it is Sarkozy who is courting the press and not the other way around. Michael Young, opinion editor for the Daily Star in Lebanon, argued recently in Reason magazine that the publicity has worked to Sarkozy's advantage. Yes, the French are tiring of his very public romance, but it's the awful publicness of it they find galling, not the romance.
The French are quite open-minded when it comes to issues of the personal life of their politicians. François Mitterrand, of course, had a daughter out of wedlock. He had numerous mistresses. Chirac, the last president, was known also as a compulsive womanizer. We can go on. I think the only one who comes out looking at least faithful to his wife is de Gaulle. And, of course, de Gaulle lived in the heavens, apparently.
So the French are famously open-minded about the sex lives of their leaders, but Sarkozy's slipping poll numbers suggest he is annoying his countrymen. Could you describe for us the scene of his Christmas trip to Egypt?
What I saw was through the wires or on websites. It was essentially descended from a private jet with his latest girlfriend, and we're not quite sure if she's since become his wife, Carla Bruni, who is a former model and a singer. And Sarkozy, in stark contrast to another French president who visited Egypt, many others, but particularly Mitterrand, came out of the airplane looking pretty much like the Corsican hoodlum with his Ray-Bans tilted forward, his shirt opened, an extra button, not looking very presidential. He really doesn't have a sense of gravitas. And so, to a certain extent, that's appealed to the French. But more recently, indeed, as you were pointing out, the polls suggested the sort of latest whirlwind romance with Carla Bruni has not really been appreciated by the French, who tend to want their politicians to be a little bit more serious.
You suggested that there is a tradition among recent French presidents to act like a monarch without being one.
Well, to a certain extent, I'm saying this. In the United States, for example, presidents, as well as now we can see this in the primary campaign, candidates, in a sense, always try to rewrite the narratives of their life. And they tend to rewrite this in many ways in the tropes of popular culture. In France, it's a different situation. Presidents have always tended to be more distant from the society. They've always tended to be a little bit more like republican monarchs. The new thing with Sarkozy is that he is, in many respects, more American in the sense that he is writing his own narrative, doing it in the tropes of popular culture.
What have the media made of this very conspicuous show of Sarkozy's personal life?
The paradox of all this is that Sarkozy is always in the news, and that's the essence of political power. In a sense, he's always there, whether it's his personal life, whether it's him going off to some political event, whether it's him trying to resolve some strike, or whether it's him going to Corsica. It's always Sarkozy, and to a certain extent, he seems to be the state. The state seems to be Sarkozy. In a way, he's rather successfully pushed the government and the prime minister to the back burner, at least in the public perception. In reality, of course, I think we should be careful not to overstate that. And he has used this omnipresence, if you will, in the media to impose himself on France and on the political system.
You did call it France's permanent reality show, and you have observed that it worked to Sarkozy's advantage, but this is just according to the principle of any publicity is good publicity?
Any publicity is good publicity, no. That would be too simple. But he has managed, I think, to be ever present in the mind of his countrymen. And in a sense, that's good as long as you can carry through policies that the public sides with. So, for example, when there was the recent spate of strikes, particularly the metro strike in Paris, public opinion, by and large, was on the side of the government and on the side of the president to a substantial degree. He came out of that looking good. But again, this permanent reality show works in his favor if the French, in a sense, are satisfied with his policies. It can, of course, turn against him if the reality show suddenly becomes essentially a bad reality show. But the point I'm trying to make is that by always being in the media, he opens spaces for himself to advance his political agenda.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes it does backfire, however.
No permanent reality show, no matter how beautiful the girls, is going to cover up for rising unemployment.
That's right. Or inflation.
Michael, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Michael Young is opinion editor of the Daily Star newspaper in Lebanon.
Celebrity can be a mixed blessing, especially if you're among the 489-some alumni of the group known as the FBI's Most Wanted. Last week, the Federal Bureau of Investigation announced that it is reinvigorating the Most Wanted program. No longer just a wanted poster at the post office, the list is now a multimedia dragnet with billboards, a revamped website, email alerts, and television partners. John Miller is FBI Assistant Director of Public Affairs. John, welcome to the show.
Good to be here, Bob.
Now, you only have to look at cable TV or America's Most Wanted on broadcast TV to see that the public has an apparently insatiable thirst for pulp nonfiction. Is there any evidence, though, that emailing me alerts of the latest member of the FBI's Most Wanted is actually going to help the FBI locate fugitives?
Well, it certainly does. And we don't guess this. We know this. You take the billboard program. This is a partnership we went into with the Clear Channel Company, where they agreed to use billboards in 20 cities. They have a Philadelphia police officer murdered. And within minutes, they were able to have that electronic billboard up with the suspect's name and picture, and they captured him, by the way. But also, take the case of Warren Jeffs. Now, Warren Jeffs was the cult leader who was charged with sexual abuse of children. He fled from Utah. It was a Nevada state trooper in Las Vegas who caught him, Had he not been on the 10 most wanted list, had that picture not been widely disseminated, when they did the car stop, they wouldn't have really recognized him, and that facilitated that capture.
The list began under the, I think, 9,000-year tenure of J. Edgar Hoover. But, you know, even back in 1950, Hoover was ambivalent. He was afraid that it would backfire by glorifying criminals, much in the way, Babyface Nelson was glorified for his bold bank robberies back in the 30s. Is that still an issue at the FBI?
It's certainly something that we thought about from the beginning. I mean, if you look at the origins of this, it was J. Edgar Hoover playing cards with a group of people, among whom was the editor of United Press. And he had a story idea, which is, let's pick out the 10 toughest gangsters that you're looking to find and do a story on them. That's probably the kind of image that those gangsters would have liked to have cast. And there was some reluctance at doing it, but the editor pressed for it and the FBI delivered. They put them out. And the United Press story, which went out on the wire, actually ran in many, many newspapers. And many of them put it on the front page with the photographs. People started to call in and they wiped out the first 10 on the list very quickly. At that point, the light bulb went on that it said, if we're going to balance between glorifying them and catching them, the numbers tell the story. I mean, there have been almost 500 people on it since March 14th, 1950, when it was launched, and all but 40 of them have been captured, and many of those as a result of the publicity that came from being a 10 Most Wanted.
I guess every police agency in the world, when it publicizes a crime, risks getting lots and lots and lots of really bad tips that it squanders resources following up. It's easy to see how you can catch bad guys doing this, but it's also easy to see how the proliferation of most wanted images will cause just a tidal wave of bad information.
It's a part of reality, but why will you assign a squad of a couple of dozen or even a couple of hundred investigators when you can assign the peeled eyes of a nation of 300 million people? And that is what we try to do. Through the Office of Public Affairs, we have a special unit called the Investigative Publicity Unit. And their job is to flip around the dial at night. You got Greta Van Susteren. You got Nancy Grace. You've got any number of these shows that are crime-obsessed. And we can channel that power in such a way that it'll bring leads forth.
Breaking news tonight. A gorgeous young Marine vanishes into thin air at Camp Lejeune. The burned remains of 20-year-old Maria Lauterbach and her unborn child found in the backyard of suspect co-Marine Corporal Caesar Lauren.
Look at the Lorianne case. Here's a guy who allegedly committed a murder, went on the run, quickly moved from the south into Texas, possibly into Mexico. We were able to blanket those regions, in fact, the nation, but target those regions with publicity and try and leverage that, and got a lot of very good leads.
So let's get back to the new ways of proliferating the 10 most wanted. I guess one risk would be so much inundation with this kind of message that instead of being more vigilant as citizens for bad guys in our midst, that it all just becomes a sort of white noise and we wind up sort of paying no attention at all. Is that just a figment of my imagination?
I think it is, and I think it is because, not because you have a vivid imagination, but because it's limited to 10, is a unique device. When we put somebody on the 10 most wanted, in almost every case, it means they're going to get caught because that elevates them to a status that brings into play a $100,000 reward, but it brings into play most of an episode of America's Most Wanted, which is viewed by millions. It puts them out there at the front of the FBI's website. It tells people that this is different. And frankly, it's almost giving celebrity status. But the payoff is almost every time we confer that status, it results in them getting locked up.
One last question. The 10 Most Wanted is probably, right up there with Coca-Cola in being one of the most recognizable brands in the world, certainly in the United States. Are you considering any other exploitation of the wanted list? You're going to be selling coffee mugs at the FBI's souvenir shop or any other way going to exploit this and actually make a buck on it?
We won't be having the FBI's 10 Most Wanted stadium. I don't think we're looking to make a buck on it. We're looking to spend money on it, and that's why we pay out that $100,000 reward at minimum, although, as you know, some people on the 10 Most Wanted list have $25 million awards. The people who profit from the 10 most wanted list are the people who call in the tips and collect the money. How do you get on the 10 most wanted list? The criteria is level of dangerousness, if you will, to the public, and the estimate of how much publicity will help a capture. And if you meet those two criteria and you're involved in a serious enough incident, you're going to end up on the 10 most wanted list. And if you end up on the 10 most wanted list, there's a 90% chance that that's going to cause you to get caught.
Hey, I got an idea. We can increase your success by 10%. Ready?
I'm ready.
The FBI's 11 most wanted.
You know, it's happened. We have had 11 most wanted. We have had specials added to the 10 most wanted. After the World Trade Center bombing in New York City, when Ramzi Ahmed Youssef was identified as the mastermind behind the bombing, there was no open spot on the 10 most wanted list. So he was one of a handful over the last 50 years that was added as a special.
All right, John, nice to talk to you again. Thanks very much.
Thanks for having me, and thanks for bringing up the program.
John Miller is the Assistant Director of Public Affairs at the Federal Bureau of Investigation. This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for On the Media comes from the Kauffman Foundation of Kansas City, the foundation of entrepreneurship, on the web at kauffman.org. The John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, helping to build a more just future for the nation and the world. The William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Many of us rely on hard drives as if they were annexes to our brains, bytes standing in for neurons to preserve information and thoughts and perhaps even secrets that would otherwise be beyond our capacity to recall. Or maybe the analogy is wrong. Maybe our computer hard drives aren't extensions of our minds, but more like stacks of filing cabinets. It's an important distinction because it concerns the ability of government to demand the contents of our computer memories. A judge in a federal district court in California ruled that hard drives serve as extensions of our own minds and therefore cannot be searched without just cause. In a much different case, a Vermont judge ruled a defendant did not have to turn over his password to authorities who wanted to inspect his encrypted hard drive for child pornography. To compel him to speak the password out loud, the judge decided, would violate his Fifth Amendment protection from self-incrimination. There are a batch of cases across the country that each in its way tries to wade into the murky waters of what protections, if any, are afforded to our data. Adam Liptak of the New York Times has been following these stories, and he joins us now. Adam, welcome back to OTM.
Thank you, Bob.
Let's start with the case of Sebastian Boucher. A judge ruled that he does not have to turn over his password to his encryption program, and that judge used the analogy of the difference between a safe with a key and a safe with a combination lock. What was he talking about?
Well, the law has always drawn a distinction between objects and what's in your brain. And even though the key to a lock and a series of numbers that's the combination to a combination lock are functionally the same thing, the law draws a distinction and says that under the Fifth Amendment, you can't be compelled to disclose what's in your brain if it's going to hurt you.
Now, with the proper search warrant, of course, the police, if they wanted to, could blow the safe, but they can't force you to simply say the combination aloud.
Yeah, and one sidelight that's sort of interesting here is that encryption programs, even relatively easily obtainable ones, are so strong that the government can't crack them. Who knew?
Who knew indeed? And that is one of the reasons the government says it's very important for it to be able to demand passwords, because otherwise drug dealers and terrorists and other criminals would merely have to take off-the-shelf software and encrypt all their data. Governments are always seeking new tools for police, but has that been successful in the past as an argument into eroding our protections from police search and seizure?
The fact that life is made hard for the cops is not a reason to do away with the Fifth Amendment or the Fourth Amendment, most courts say. Although these cases all arise in this funny setting, all of these guys had their computers inspected as they were crossing the American border. And another kind of who knew point is at the border, you really have no rights. At the border, just as they can rummage through your luggage and look at your dirty underwear, the government can rummage through what's on your computer. And these days, what's on your computer, as you were suggesting at the beginning, Bob, is just about everything about you. So the border turns out to be a privacy-free zone.
I'm wondering whether new law has to be written to accommodate the difference between going through your hard drive, which is just a vast storage area with so much personal information about you, including medical records possibly and who knows what all.
Confidential sources.
And a 1,000 notebooks that you may be carrying in a steamer trunk. The government's always been able to go through the notebooks. But is there something fundamentally different about data stored on a hard drive and the data that you may record by hand?
The appeals court seemed to say, no, there isn't.
Do you have any sense that individual judges' lack of computer literacy might have an effect on how they view what analogy should be used?
I think that appeals court judges are older, don't much work in the digital world. I was having lunch the other day with two appeals court judges here in New York who told me that when they wanted to communicate with another judge in the court, they faxed a memo over. I said, does anyone use email? He goes, no, email is too modern for us. There's just not an understanding that in a way what we carry around on our digital devices these days is like a diary times a million. At the same time, they're not wrong. It's just it's like the old world, except so much more. And is there some point in which the so much more crosses a line and becomes different in kind? And that's a hard question for the law.
Now, that appeals court that said there's no difference between ordinary notebooks and possessions and what's in your computer, would that give the government, for example, license to routinely download everybody's hard drive at the border and sift through it at their leisure on just fishing expeditions?
That is the key question. And what the Electronic Frontier Foundation, a civil liberties group, says is that this is a way of sort of after-the-fact complete electronic surveillance. You just make a mirror image of everybody's computer as it comes over the border. And that's not crazy talk. It's not wholly hypothetical. Quite neutral organization called the Association of Corporate Travel Executives say they have, from their membership, had reports of computers being held for a week or so. You show up at the border, they take your computer, they mail it back to you. And in the meantime, they've made a mirror image of it.
The sitting Supreme Court has taken a very hard line against individual freedoms in the case of search and seizure. I wonder if there's anything the court has done to sort of tip its hand as to how it might rule, almost certainly will rule eventually, in one of these cases.
Well, you got a pretty good idea of where they're going by the fact that the appeals court judges really have no sympathy for the argument that your computer is any different from your suitcase. And my best guess is that at least at the border, the U.S. Supreme Court will follow all of these other judges in saying that you carry your computer with you at your own risk.
Does that mean it's time for Congress to step in to head the Supreme Court off at the pass?
It's possible that Congress might want to do that, although the standard response, the argument closer, is, wait a second, we're talking about people with child pornography on their computers, and to catch them, it's okay to give up all of our other privacy. Because child pornography is sort of the elephant in the room, whatever Congress might want to do in the abstract, I would be very surprised if politicians were willing to act if it was at the expense of not catching child pornographers.
Adam, as always, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Bob.
Adam Liptak is national legal correspondent for the New York Times.
If he won, he'd be the first American world champion in history. If he lost, he'd just be another Pazza from Brooklyn. On the 40th move of the 21st game, he countered Spassky's bishop to king 6 with a pawn to rook 4. And it was all over. He came home an American hero. Then Bobby Fischer made the most original and unexpected move of all. He disappeared.
That's from the movie Searching for Bobby Fischer, about one chess prodigy here recounting the exploits of another, the chess prodigy, Bobby Fischer. Last week, Fischer died in Iceland at the age of 64. The obituaries had to reconcile two opposing portraits of the man, one of the Cold War hero who beat the Soviet Union at its own game in 1972, and the other of an unstable fugitive raging against Americans and Jews. Many journalists summed up his life with a chess metaphor, bold opening moves and a tragic endgame. We'll never know what went on in Fischer's head, but his public dramas played out on a global stage. Frank Brady is chair of mass communications at St. John's University, head of the Marshall Chess Club, and author of Bobby Fischer, Profile of a Prodigy. He says that right from the start, Fischer was a media magnet.
Well, he was a natural in terms of story ideas and photo ops. Here was this little boy, 10, 11 years old, dressed in corduroy slacks, flannel shirt, and sneakers in these staid environments playing against people who were physicists and lawyers and judges and doctors. And he captured the imagination of the press and the imagination of the public.
Let's talk about the interview that Ralph Ginzburg had with Fischer in Harper's in 1962. Now, here he is, a young man of 18, quite good-looking, impeccably dressed, and a real schmo. I think Ginzburg wrote it himself. I have the quote here. Though Fischer is 18 years old, he shows some traits of much younger children who behave as if the world is centered around filling their needs.
Yes. I remember that article well. I was actually interviewed by Ginzburg for it. I talked to Bobby about it many times. Up until that point, articles that appeared about him in local newspapers and so forth that just sort of outlined his achievements. Ginzburg did an in-depth article and spent a great deal of time with him, and he wrote a really finely written article. But it exposed Bobby in a way that he had never been exposed before. It showed him as anti-feminist. It showed him as anti-Semitic. And, of course, being a Jew, that was pretty inconsistent. He was extremely naive and sophomoric and solipsistic. And he showed that to Ginzburg. This one particular article really turned Fischer off of the media.
That's interesting, because it was a pretty devastating piece.
It certainly was.
So much of it is in the form of dialogue, which I guess we have to trust was accurate.
Yeah, Ginzburg didn't misquote him at all. The most ironic and poignant thing that I felt that he said is that he wanted someday to live in a house that was shaped like a rook.
Now, Fischer reached the apex of his career in 1972 with the world championship match against Boris Spassky.
This championship match between you and Spassky, is it in any sense a grudge match?
That was Mike Wallace interviewing Fischer before the match.
In a sense. I mean, not personally against me, against Spassky, because, you know, I don't care 2 cents about him one way or the other. He's just another guy. But it's against the Russians and, you know, all the lies they've been saying about me.
Do you worry about Spassky?
Not overly. I mean, he's a little better, I think, than the other Russians I've taken on in this series.
Let's talk about the PBS coverage of those matches and what it meant for chess and for the Cold War.
Well, I actually was the PBS correspondent in Reykjavik. It really created a sensation. People in New York City and throughout the nation were playing in restaurants and playing on park benches and playing all over the place. All of a sudden, chess dominated the country like it normally would dominate in the Soviet Union. I mean, the United States Chess Federation had about 5,000 members before 1972. And around 1973, they had about 100,000 members.
Wow.
And people were playing in tournaments all over the country, as they still are. We're still feeling the strength and vitality of Fischer.
Did all the attention warp Bobby Fischer?
I wouldn't say it warped him, but it made him Garbo-like. I think he just became very reclusive. If he found that one of his friends had made a friend of a journalist, he would often cut them off.
Did he ever play for the cameras or for the journalists? Didn't he once claim that Muhammad Ali stole the line, "I am the greatest," from him?
He certainly did. And Fischer could do a little bit of an act, especially on television. He knew who he was. He was the zeitgeist of chess. He was the icon. He was more than an icon. He was chess. And he knew it.
People have been calling me arrogant for many years, but lately they're not calling me arrogant. Why? Because now, you know, I've been winning all these matches and I'm doing what I've always said I was, you know. So I used to say I was the best player in the world. Everybody's arrogant, terrible, conceited person, you know.
Right.
But this is just an obvious fact.
The fact that here, this kid from Brooklyn, poor, living in Park Slope, high school dropout, takes on the entire Soviet Union. And by the way, now that the KGB archives have been released, we find out that every grandmaster in Russia was required to write an analysis not only of Fischer's chess, but his personality as well, as they knew him, as they played him over the years.
Frequently, commentators, pundits, the press in general, wanted to depict Bobby Fischer as just out-and-out nuts.
Oh, his anti-Semitic statements, denying of the Holocaust, applauding 9/11, saying America got what it deserved. I mean, these were outrageous statements. It depends on what your definition of sanity or insanity is. I personally just think he was a mean-spirited son of a bitch, a mean-spirited, evil kind of guy who was politically outre, and he developed this over the years.
So then I think it's fair to say that the media in the later years had him pegged.
Yeah, they had him pegged. There's one problem that the media has with chess, unfortunately, and that is sometimes the media equates madness with chess. They think that anybody who reaches that height in chess has to be insane, and that's untrue. There are people walking around in the media, newspapers in New York City, you know, top reporters who are great chess players.
So let's talk about Fischer's final chapter, the last 15 years. I'll just briefly summarize. He defied U.S. law and he went to Yugoslavia to play a pretty lucrative rematch against Boris Spassky in 1992. Afterwards, he was wanted by the U.S. authorities for playing that match. He couldn't return home. He called a station in the Philippines on 9/11 to say that the terrorist attacks were great news.
Finish off the U.S. once and for all. But I'm hoping for some kind of a seven-day in May scenario where the country will be taken over by the military. They'll close down all the synagogues, arrest all the Jews, execute hundreds of thousands of Jewish ringleaders.
And then finally, Iceland gave him asylum. He lived there until his death. As you heard the reports about Fischer through the years, did any of it surprise you?
It saddened me. It saddened me that he was the way he was. And I had hoped, I had given a speech just about a month ago about Bobby, and it was on YouTube and it was on public broadcast. And I hoped that he had seen it. Little did I know that he saw it on his deathbed. The charges are going to be dropped. Pay your back income tax. He hadn't paid his income tax since 1972. And get on with your
72
life.
72?
72.
Wow.
Get on with your life. And come back to chess. We miss you. We want you. And apologize to the Jews of this world. And apologize to the Americans for what you said.
It's a tall order you gave him, isn't it?
And probably totally naive on my part to even suggest it.
Were you in contact with him then in recent years?
No, I was in touch with him just a few weeks ago. He saw my speech on YouTube. And I told a little anecdote about him drinking a bottle of Löwenbräu in the Marshall Chess Club, which you're not allowed to do. There's no drinking allowed. But I allowed him to do it. And he, through an intermediary, sent a little note.
It sounds like he was watching his media coverage to the end.
Yeah, and I'm sure he kept looking on the internet and the blogs and seeing what people were saying about him. You know, he did call in to a match on a Reykjavik television station, a chess match. And someone had made a slightly weak move, and he called up. And that was just a few months ago, and said, you know, you could have done much better by playing your rook to this position and your knight over here. So that was actually his last real public statement.
Frank, thank you so much.
Thank you, Brooke.
Frank Brady is chair of mass communication, journalism, and television and film at St. John's University and author of Bobby Fischer, Profile of a Prodigy.
She hasn't got time to make you wise. Cause it's time, it's time, it's
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Megan Ryan, Jamie York, Mike Volo, Mark Phillips, and Nazanin Rafsanjani, and edited by Brooke. We had technical direction from Jennifer Munson and more engineering help from Paul Schneider. We also had help from Ian Whitehead, Nadia Zonis, Sasha Evans, and Andy Lancet. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer, and John Keefe, our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. This is On the Media from WNYC. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media is provided by the Bidell Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the John and Anna Maria Phillips Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC. This is NPR.